I'm writing crime. That's my genre. I wanted to write something which would be the worst thing that I could possibly imagine. And I thought, well, this kind of is, in a way, it's worse to have a missing child, I think, than a child who's gone. I think there are a lot of books which do go too far, and I think that probably you can have more effect if you deal with something with a light touch.
Welcome to Bestsellers. I'm Natalie Jameson.
And I'm Phil Williams, and we have a returning guest.
So Imran Mahmood is today's guest. And well, the first time I'd met him in person was when we did this live event at the Chiltern Kills Crime Writing Festival in 2023. And such a lovely guy, Imran.
Really nice.
Yeah, I've read one of his books before this one. I hadn't read his debut, which we do talk about a little bit in this episode, but I do want to go read that now because it sounds phenomenal. But yeah, just such a, it was just one of those kind of really good souls, you know, when you spend time with somebody, and I really respect what he has to say and the manner that he says it.
Quite right too. Yeah, I did him for his debut on the radio, You Don't Know Me, which is was a phenomenal, instantly, the minute you read it, it's one of those books, it's just not like anything else. And so it's about a kid who's up on a charge, fires his barrister and delivers the closing speech to the jury as himself, as the defendant. So it's written in first person. It's written in kind of street slang, jive talk. And so it was incredibly difficult. It would have been so easy to get it wrong. Because the minute you get it wrong, you veer off into Ali G territory. Do you know what I mean? And so it would have been really easy for that to go wrong. But it was authentic. It felt authentic. And it was immaculately, the narrative's really well told. So yeah, I recommend that very highly to you. And we're about to talk to him on his fourth book. And the fact that he still practices law as well, I think, really helps and informs the writing.
Yeah. And he, again, just such a fascinating guy. And loads of things to talk about in this episode, from parenting to the writing process. Yes, I really hope you enjoy it. Here is Phil with the intro.
Our guest today on Bestsellers is a returning guest in many guises. We've interviewed him as a standalone before. We also interviewed him last year when we did our first live episode at Chiltern Kills as part of an excellent panel. And he told us about this book then. And I can't believe it's come around already. The release of Imran Mahmood's fourth book, which is called Finding Sophie, which we need to be really careful how much we say, i.e. very little about, because it's kind of one of those books where I feel certainly that if you come to it knowing nothing, you'll get more enjoyment from the book. It's lovely to have you back on Bestsellers, my friend. Thanks for doing this.
Lovely to be invited on. Thank you.
So, Finding Sophie, I want to get straight into this because I devour this. I've messaged you separately and I said, I think this is your best book yet. And I genuinely mean that. I want to know what the inspiration was for the story, because from the offset, when we joined this book, there's a 17-year-old girl's gone missing. Mom and dad are beside themselves. You and I are both, well, we're all parents on this. Natalie's got a daughter. You've got daughters. I've got two sons. It's a parent's worst fear. Why would you, as a right-thinking individual, want to create a story about that?
This is a great question. Thank you.
You're welcome. No further questions, my lord.
I think you hit the nail on the head there when you said it's every parent's worst nightmare. And I think when I was thinking about what to write next, I'm writing crime, that's my genre. I wanted to write something which would be the worst thing that I could possibly imagine. And I thought, well, this kind of is, in a way, it's worse to have a missing child, I think, than a child who's gone. And the reason for that, I think, is that you're trapped in kind of two coexisting states. You don't know at that point, if you've got a missing child, whether to fully involve yourself in the grief and kind of work yourself towards closure, or whether you're supposed to keep up hope and be optimistic and have drive in your search for your child. You know, which of the two emotions do you hold more dearly? Because it feels sometimes as though if you kind of indulge in the grief part of it, that feels slightly disloyal to your need to hope and to be optimistic and to continue your search. And the other way around too. I mean, if you're at the convinced that your missing child is alive, then if they're not alive, then have you in some ways betrayed them? It must be a really difficult tightrope to walk. And I thought that in a way would be the ultimate nightmare, missing child.
You seem to have thought about it a lot. Was it based on, because I should have told you listening that Imran is a barrister as well as a writer. So is this based on a case that maybe you've been part of, or have you just had this thought through paranoia about your own children?
Well, one of the things that sometimes we don't realise as members of the public is that you can be tried for murder even without a body. And when there are those cases around, I think that the families are even, in some ways, even more torn than the families of those people who've lost, definitely lost people. And that's not to in any way diminish what they're feeling, but just this idea. I mean, I don't know what it would be like if you were attending a trial and the defense case was, that person's probably still alive. I definitely didn't kill them. They're alive. They're somewhere else, but I don't know where they are. What do you do as a parent? Do you desperately hope that they're right and that they're acquitted because they are right? Or do you desperately hope that somebody pays the price for a murder? It must be really difficult. And that kind of tension of not knowing where to be on that line is one of the things which drove this.
And you play with those emotions because you have the parents, and one of them, when we sort of meet them, does think that the child is dead and the other one thinks that the child is alive. So you've got those kind of opposing views, but you do sit in that world for much of the book. And again, I don't want to give anything away about what happens and, you know, which way it goes. But how was it in the process of writing that? Whilst I can appreciate that it's enjoyable to discover something new and to kind of play with those emotions, I kind of felt so viscerally when I was reading it that it was so sad for a lot of it. Did that come out when you were writing it? Did it make you feel sad as well for the writing process? Because that sounds miserable.
I mean, there's no way, I think, that to write that kind of this level of pain without kind of absorbing some of it yourself. And what I usually make the mistake when I'm writing characters to kind of deeply inhabit them. So when I'm, and plus they're written in the first person, so when I'm writing their voices, the characters are saying, I am doing X, Y, and Z. So that brief time, I say brief, there's a few hours that I'm writing that character. That character becomes, I become in a way that character and try and feel, think, and have the same kind of breadth of emotions that that character is having. So yeah, it did feel slightly as if I had to tear the book out of myself. It was, the comfort was that I knew it wasn't real. Mm-hmm. That was the really comforting thing. So you are, in some ways, it's a kind of simulacrum of their emotions. So you're not kind of deep into it. So I'm not sobbing as I'm writing it. But yeah, there's definitely some of it does rub off. I was reminded of I think it might be a Sufi saying, but there's a saying which says something like, if you spend all day working in a perfume factory, then when you leave, you will leave smelling of that perfume. And I think that there's something of that in the writing. When you walk away from it, some of that still clings to you, I think.
Yeah, but I think the empathy of that is so vital, because I know that Phil reads a lot more crime thrillers than I do, but part of the thing that I've always sometimes struggled with is if that empathy is lacking in some way, which is not the case here at all. So I think it's also a really important thing to have in there, which I'm guessing is why you wanted to show that.
Yeah, so there are, obviously, crime is one of those genres which kind of spreads a kind of whole continuum. That spectrum is massive, from the kind of noir-y crime, the police procedurals. You'll have very plot-driven crimes. Some are kind of cross-genre. For me, the thing I've always been interested in is more the kind of human dynamic side of the novels. So what kind of the internality, what drives somebody, what are they thinking, how are they feeling? And I think that some of that must come from doing the work. So when I'm in the day job, when I'm representing people who are accused of crimes, but the thing that really I try and get to the bottom of, particularly, you know, if you're dealing with somebody who has pleaded guilty, but then you're trying to work out what's led them to this thing, what's going on in their head when they're doing this awful crime, what are the processes, what are the social conditions, what's led to because it feels a bit like a domino fall. Something has happened early on in somebody's life and it leads them to a place, and that can be a kind of an event, a physical happenstance, or it can be something internal, something that's driven them emotionally to that place. And that's always been the thing that's fascinated me, rather than the kind of building blocks of just the plot, rather than, you know, who killed who, why did they kill them, how do we find them. For me, it's always been more about the people.
And given that, what you just discussed with Natalie, and ultimately somebody listening to this right now will make a decision to buy your book or not based on whether they will enjoy it as a piece of entertainment. That's what these novels are, really, aren't they? They're pieces of entertainment. Do you have that in the back of your mind as well when you're thinking about how far do you go? You know, ostensibly, you've got a story here about a missing teenager. I mean, I found it utterly gripping and I didn't find it too far. And I noticed that since I've become a father myself, a lot of books go too far for me. Are you aware of where the line is when you're writing?
Yeah, it's definitely something which I've got in the forefront of my mind, because I agree with you. I think there are a lot of books which do go too far. And I think that probably you can have more effect if you deal with something with a light touch and leave quite a lot unsaid. I don't know whether you're similar vintage to me, but I was growing up, I used to watch Hammer House and Bones. In the 50s or 40s, Dracula would pull a cloak over his victim and you kind of guess the rest, and you'd your imagination would take over. And I think,
well, that's an old Hitchcockian thing, isn't it? I mean, the famous one for me is Reservoir Dogs, and you don't actually see the fella's ear being cut off, but you see the blade in Jay, or what's his face, Marsden's hand, the actor, and then he's dancing and you get the music and you know it's coming, but you don't actually see a knife go down the side of an ear and chop it off. But in your imagination, it's way worse.
I think that's an important device, because I think if you do that, then what you do is that you engage the reader in the story in a more fundamental level than if you're just putting it all out there on the page or all out there on the screen, because then that story becomes theirs, because the thing that's going on in their head, imagining the realities, picturing it, picturing the people, that becomes their story. So I think in that way you fulfill your contract with the reader at a kind of greater, more enjoyable level than if you just spell it all out for them. So I try not to be overly descriptive of characters, the way they look, for example, because if you don't like the way they look and it's been told to you, then you're stuck with that character for the whole book. A character who you might find offensive, whereas at least if you're drawing your own pictures in your own head to your own limits, then it's fine. I think that's the same with how gruesome or not a crime novel is or could be. If you're setting your own limits as you're reading it, you know, the door is shut and you can hear what's going on, then at least you're never going to offend your readers, because you're relying on their imaginations to do some of that lifting with you.
I think also what you have done so well in this book too is, you know, we've been talking about it is entertaining, but it is obviously very sad as well, but you allow time for that to happen. When we were chatting to S.A. Cosby recently, we were sort of, he was sort of very rightly saying how he's not a fan of crime thrillers or mystery thrillers where there's violence, but then, you know, people get up the next day and they seem to have forgotten that they got knocked out and stuff. And that's what I liked about this as well, is that if the, you know, something so awful has happened, it's not something that's going to be forgotten. People are still going to be in this state of, you know, should I eat today? Or like, do I want to get dressed? Or do I want to wash? Like all that kind of stuff. With the timelines of it and the kind of the length of grieving or not grieving, did you have that plotted out before you went in, or were you sort of writing as you went?
I almost never plot in advance in any kind of detail. Where I'll do it on, you know, the back of a fag packet, kind of. I'll be able to say, look, this story is about X, and at the end, this will happen. So I know that. And in fact, I was listening to a conversation between John Grisham and Lee Child, and they were talking about whether they were plotters or not. And Grisham was saying, yeah, I plot everything meticulously, and this is why I do it. And he has spreadsheets and everything else. And Lee Child says, I don't plot a thing. I just get up in the morning, I tell you what's going to happen. And it's the only way that he can write, because he wants to know what is going to happen next, rather than already knowing it and then having the motivation taken away from him. And for me, I try to plot novels before, and what I find happening is that I'm trying to get a character to do something which is something that the character is resisting, doesn't want to do it, because it's not ready. The time isn't right for that thing to happen. And so you end up shoehorning characters into a timeline too quickly, so that you're moving a plot to a particular point too quickly. And then for me, it makes other people can do it really well. John Grisham, for example, does it beautifully. But for me, it makes my characters a bit kind of clunky, I think. And so some of this, as you say, the characters have time, but that's partly because I think that's how, for example, that's how grief works. Grief is there demanding to be felt. You can't ignore grief. It's there. You've got to go through it. And it makes you go through those emotions. You can't just put it in the bin and move on to the next bit. But there will come a point at which you can see through the fog of that, and or there'll come a point at which you have to continue through the grief, and that's where the plot can travel. It doesn't mean that you leave the metaphorical dog kind of in the garden. You keep him in the story. You keep that grief in the story, and it helps, I think, give it depth and texture. That hasn't answered your question at all, has it?
No, it has. No, that's great. And I also, I always want to plot when I'm writing, but I'm not very good at that. So I am always heartened when there are more people who just like, yeah, just wing it.
It doesn't feel like winging it, because, and I think you probably would feel that this, that each kind of bit of that, each page or each line of it is, in a way, completely unforced by a kind of character, like a pattern. You don't have to force it into place, and then it feels organic, I think. And I think I can usually tell when something's been plotted and when it hasn't, because of the way it comes out. The one person I didn't guess correctly was Janice Hallett, who has such kind of complex plot. And I was talking to her one day, and she was saying, oh, yeah, I don't plot any of it. And I said, I don't know how you manage it, because there are like 1,000 moving parts. I don't know how she does it, but she says she doesn't plot a thing.
Can we get you to read a bit then from your new book, From Finding Sophie? Tell us where we join this.
We will join this right at the beginning, chapter one. So the way that the structure of the book is, you've got two voices, Harry and Zara. They're the parents, and they alternate. But in between that, we've got a trial happening in the Old Bailey. And so that is kind of woven in between those two narrative accounts. And it's it kicks off chapter one, and it says, "Now, Old Bailey, courtroom three. I've been waiting a year for my trial, but now that I'm here, I can't contain the panic blooming in my gut. I'm in the glass-walled dock of Court Three of the Old Bailey. The courtroom, panelled in satinwood, is cavernous. The desks in front of me cascade gently down four rows, narrow and impractical looking. In the distance, the judge's bench is attended by a pair of empty red leather chairs. The room brims with decades-old scents, and I am drowning. My barrister, Stan Stevens, is middle-aged with streaks of silver in his otherwise black hair. He is small, but he bristles with energy as if permanently plugged into a power source. His voice is shrill, and sometimes he shouts even at me, his client, but I like him. There's always a gleam in his eyes if he knows things nobody else does. He barrels towards me and slaps his hand on the glass wall. Jailer, can I speak to my client? Justin here is fine. The security guard opens the door to let him in and then locks it again. Stevens sits next to me, eyes flashing. Okay, I don't want you to react to the prosecution's speech. I know this prosecutor. He's a tit, but he's not stupid. I mean, he's not as clever as me, but he is cleverer than you. Don't give him an excuse to stitch you up. And when the jury comes in, don't look at them. Why? Because if you're looking at them, they'll think you're trying to get their sympathy. Juries don't like being played. I nod, but can't help noticing the slimness of the black vial in his hand as I do. It seems almost empty.
So listen, let me ask you this. As you've started and the novel starts in the courtroom, and I've already said that you're a barrister as well as a writer, there's a quote I've lifted from the end of the book, so I can't offer any context to this quote, but in isolation, this won't blow any of your story. And it's to do with a justice principle. And in the book, it says that principle is that it is better to let nine guilty people go free than convict one innocent person of a crime that he or she did not commit. Does that principle still hold true? And do you see it at play in courtrooms that you're working in?
Yeah. That's the kind of golden thread which runs through the criminal justice system, which is why we have such a high standard of proof in criminal cases. So you have to you have to be sure of guilt as a juror before you can convict. That used to be phrased as you have to be sure beyond all reasonable doubt before you can convict. But it's the same thing. And to say that it's better to let 10 guilty men go free than to hang one innocent is a reflection of that principle, which is it's much better to be sure of guilt so that there are no doubts. And that, I suppose, comes from a time when we were in fact executing people. And you know, there's no appeal against a hanging once it's been carried out. And so I think that principle holds true. It's a thing that people still say to juries in closing speeches, in closing argument. Sometimes you'll have a judge saying, well, Mr. Mahmood has just said it's better to let 10 guilty men go free. And of course, he's entitled to say that. But the standard that you're concerned with is, are you sure of guilt? Nothing less will do. And that's, you know, that's how he'll direct it. But there's nothing wrong in saying that. I think it's probably true, because it probably can't be very much worse than being convicted of an offence when you're innocent. And we've seen recently, there are always cases where people have been released after 30 years in prison, sometimes in America, or on death row, and then some new bit of evidence turns up which shows that they categorically were innocent.
Yeah, and the last time we did Michael Connolly on this podcast, who I'm sure I know you're a fan of as well as we are,
yeah,
he'd just done a Mickey Hall, a Lincoln Lawyer novel, and he said that he has to limit the Lincoln Lawyer novels because ultimately they will end in a courtroom because he's a lawyer. But I've noticed one of the things you do is you put bits of court throughout several of your books, but the court isn't it's not the dominating theme here. It's the parents that are the dominating theme. So is that your way around the Lincoln Lawyer trap?
I think so. I think what happens is my agent loves the courtroom bits, and the publishers often want the courtroom bits, and I like doing the courtroom bits because it's the arena I'm familiar with. So it's, in a way, that's the bit which doesn't really require any research except for getting up in the morning and putting my wig in my bag. That bit I can do without looking anything up. But also, I think there is something kind of incredibly tense about being in a courtroom and or watching a criminal trial in particular. And that moment before the jury delivers a verdict, every time it happens, I mean, you're just, you know, the foreperson stands up and they're asked about their verdict and they're just about to deliver it. That 3-4 seconds, I always feel like I'm about to have a heart attack.
So for a journalist, let me tell you that that moment, the heart attack moment, comes just before that, when you sat outside reading Viz or whatever, because you've been waiting for 4 or 5 days for a verdict, and the tannoy goes, all parties in Crown versus Jameson to court number 6. And you're, oh, we're
why
on.
Why is it me? What have I done?
That's the moment.
Yeah.
Although you've done court as well, haven't you, Nat? You've done loads of court.
I have. I've also sat on a jury.
Have you?
Which, yeah, I have.
Are you allowed to talk about that without being guilty of contempt? Let's refer to our barrister.
I think I can because the case collapsed. So there was nothing either way. And without any specifics, the only thing I would say is that it's the most terrifying thing I think I've ever done.
Really?
Yeah. Just in terms of the, so, you know, you go and you hear like the prosecution case and then you'll kind of walk into this room with 11 other strangers and some of them might go, well, like they're clearly guilty then. And you're like, yeah, you've only heard one side of the story.
I'll tell you a funny story. I was talking to a journalist, I won't name him, at a festival. And he said, oh, I did jury service. I said, what was it like? He said, oh, I was the foreman. I said, how do you find it? He says, well, what I'll tell you is this. He said, after the case, I went round the jury room just to get a straw poll, guilty or not guilty. He says, it was all going fine. They were going guilty, not guilty, guilty. As we were going round, got to the last guy, and he said, I think the first guy is not guilty, but the second guy guilty. And he said to him, there's only one guy on trial.
Oh, no.
He said, well, who's that other guy in the dock with him, whispering to him the whole time? And he said, well, that's the interpreter. And he'd gone through the entire trial thinking that two
And he
of
thought
them
the interpreter had done it.
Well, he thought the interpreter was really dodgy because he kept muttering at him. And the reason he was muttering was because he was interpreting what he was hearing.
That's hilarious. Yeah. And we should just explain, for if you're listening overseas, you would never do jury duty, would you, Imran? Because you're a barrister, so that kind of exempts you from it.
No, well,
it's an experience you'll never have.
It used to exempt me, but now I can do it.
And really? It's changed?
Yeah, and I have done it. In fact, judges can be on juries.
I didn't know that.
And police officers now can be on juries. And I've done jury service.
It's an experience, right?
It certainly is. It certainly is. But I think it's probably the best system. I think it's the best system we've got. And there is something about 12 minds being better than one, even if that one mind is the mind of a kind of judicial genius. I think 12 minds is, there is something in that massive experience which just gives you the right answer in most cases, I think.
Has it changed the way that you now represent clients?
Not really, because one of the things that you realise is that every jury is different. Some juries are really attentive. Some of them are falling asleep. And it also depends on where you are. And you can be in somewhere quite middle class, where you know all of the members of the jury are quite middle class and have particular, you could probably guess their views. And there are other bits of London where, for example, inner London used to be a Crown Court where everyone got acquitted. That was because of where it was. But now, because the demographic has changed, and now it's full of, you know, that area now has quite a lot of millionaires living in it, then the kind of their approach to the evidence has changed. It is strange how different juries can be depending on where they're from, and you know, and also the luck of the draw. You could just have a jury of, for example, all men or all women or all black people or all Asian people or a mix, and it does change the way in which I think the way in which they return their verdicts. But we're not allowed to ask about, go behind their verdicts, because that is contempt. And so you never fully know what's going on, except for the stories that people hear once they've done jury service.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Can I just ask you about coming to writing at the time when you did? Because were you in your 40s when your first book was published? And why did it take that long to complete a book? Was it a confidence issue? Was it a time issue?
So I'd been writing short stories for ages, not to have published, but just to write them, because I suppose I was just processing the things which I found interesting or kind of difficult or challenging, or and I was just, it was just a way of getting those emotions out onto the page. But I had literally no thought or intention of having those things published. And there were a couple of people in chambers I'd give them to read, and one of the friends of mine who would read the stories would say, "God, all your stuff's really depressing, isn't it?" And it was. And so I had no kind of thought to publishing. And then it was all, only when I had been involved in a murder, representing somebody in a murder, and I was working on a jury speech, that I suddenly started thinking about this idea of whether or not the way I tell a story in a jury speech is going to be wildly different to the way somebody else would tell it, particularly if that somebody else was a defendant. You know, what would be important to him compared to what is important to me? I'm really just a bridge between his defence and the jury. It's a way of kind of pitching that story to them in a way that I think is persuasive. But what's to say that he can't do it himself? And then I started writing You Don't Know Me, which is a jury essentially a jury speech from a defendant who sacked his own barrister. And that's how that came about. But that was written in, I think, 6 or 8 months. I wrote that reasonably quickly. And then once I'd written it, I'd given a book to my wife to read before that. And it's all kind of slightly coincided. And she said, "Yeah, this is really good. You should write something like this, but less boring." when I wrote You Don't Know Me, I wrote it with this idea of it just being kind of a fast-paced thriller. That was what I was aiming for something not boring. And she read it and said, "Yeah, this is better. This is better."
Well, it's exceptional. Have you read that?
No,
you've read it.
No, I have.
You've
not read it. Oh, no.
Honestly, treat yourself. It's an exceptional book. I couldn't believe it was your debut when I first picked that up. Honestly, it's such a well written, and also, so it's written in a kind of street patois style from the first person defendant. And I've never forgotten him when I interviewed you on the radio about it and asked you why you didn't do the audiobook yourself. And you were just like, "Well, no," because who did it in the end? It was
Adam Deacon.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, Adam Deacon. And he did it. I was lucky enough to watch him recording it. And he's an actor, number one, so he knows what he's doing. But also, he kind of understands that world really well. And he was just brilliant. And the number of people that said, you know, that book wouldn't have been the same without his audio and the way he'd done it.
You don't want it to slip into pastiche, do you? That's the thing.
That's the thing, and it's so easily done, I imagine. So you want somebody to give it that authenticity, and he just did it. He nailed it. Quite a lot of it in one take. He was brilliant. He was just sat in a booth. I think he was there for 8 hours at a stretch. So proper job. He earned his cross doing that. But the thing was quite funny was my editor on that, who did most of the editing, Emad, who now is at Orion, but at the time he was in MJ, Penguin.
So I've met Emad. So he's Mike Connolly's editor now.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And he's brilliant. I love Emad. And when we were doing this, we both kind of independently had to read out kind of to ourselves every line of that to make sure that there were no kind of bum notes in it, and then he would do the same, and then we spent quite a lot of time wondering whether or not some of a slang should be in there, whether the swear words should be cut down. We cut down quite a lot of them. And then we invented some of the slang in there as well, because
Oh, did you?
Yeah, because one of the things we realised was that slang gets really quickly outdated.
Yeah.
And so unless you're using something quite standardised, it's often just as well to invent something. And so we invented a couple of things here or there to stick in there. But, and then when they made the TV show out of it, the screenwriter, who is brilliant, he is called Tom Edge, who's done loads of stuff. He's one of them the most kind of prolific screenwriters in Britain. And I was thinking, how is he going to do this? Because he's a middle-aged white guy and middle class, bright, honestly. And he produced a screenplay. It was stunning. And one of the reasons it worked so well on screen was that when the director was handing out the scripts, Sam Masuda directed it, he would listen to the actors. And some of the actors would say, actually, we wouldn't say this line. This is how we would say it. And so they were altering the shooting script right up to the last second before shooting. And he was taking a lot of kind of direction from the young guys who were playing the various roles.
Which is great that he was open to that, isn't it? That's, you know,
yeah.
trust your experts, right?
Yeah, a lot of directors, I don't think, would have done it. And I think... Yeah, you always come up against a bit of friction if you try and change, you know, something which has been handed out. That's the script that everybody's signed off on, and then you're as a director, you're saying, "Well, why don't you try it?" Because there's a bit in it where they're speaking Yoruba, that wasn't in the script. There's no way Tom Edge knew any Yoruba to put in, but that was because Sam had said to the actors, "Well, what would you speak at home? How would you do it?" And he was saying, we'd speak Yoruba. He said, well, can we try that? And there were bits in there, which I think those bits were some of the bits which worked really well.
I want to read a passage out from Finding Sophie from your latest novel. And I'll explain why in a second. Sophie arrived in the world small and angry and sucking at an invisible nipple. In a way, she took us completely by surprise, even though we'd yearned for her. But we didn't have the imagination to understand how life-destroying a baby would be. I don't mean that the way it sounds. I mean that she tore the fabric of everything we knew apart. We used to lie in bed watching TV, tray of croissants, coffee between us. In the afternoons, we'd sit through long pub lunches or visit art galleries. We used to be undefined by anything but ourselves. Then Sophie came, and all that changed. She became a supermassive center of gravity. Our tiny individual worlds revolved around her the minute she erupted into being. Now, I read that in isolation from the plot, and was delighted that someone has finally put to page just how fucking hard it is to be a parent, right? Because no one told me. I kind of went into it blind, and I've been dumbstruck by how difficult it is. Did that motivate that, or was it just that it fed your plot and it fed your character, or have you also been dumbstruck? You've got three, I think, haven't you?
Oh, yeah, I've got two. And that is exactly how it felt to us when we had our first daughter. The first thing is, you're right, nobody really tells you what it's going to be like. All your friends and family say, oh, I have children. But they don't say, you know, they don't tell you the rest of it. But they say, I have children, it'll be great. And it is great. But they don't tell you that it costs everything you've got. Kind of not just financially, but in terms of your every waking moment to have them. So that was just me kind of feeding off that experience of what it was like. And it really, I think, is like that. You don't sleep again. And sometimes they do tell you, when you have a child, you never sleep again. But you think it's, you know, because you have to do night feeds and, you know, that will stop after, you know, a year.
Yeah.
But it's not that. It's at every stage of it, something else will happen which will keep you awake. And then your ability to sleep just goes. And you don't have, the free time doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. It's the unpredictable. But I'll tell you, I'll give you a snapshot of my last two evenings in the Williams household, right? Evening before last, right? I've got my laptop on my lap in the lounge. I'm doing some work. 7-year-old comes down, opens the lounge door, says, Dad, can you read to me, please? And obviously, we don't do a books podcast to not read to our kids, right? Yeah. So I drop the laptop straight upstairs and I'm reading to him, right? So last night, when I wasn't doing any work, I thought, well, I'm going to offer. So I went to his room and he was on his iPad doing some artwork. And I said, would you like Daddy to read to you again tonight? He went, no, thank you. And then looks away. And I'm like, right, okay, so what's going on there? How do I process that emotionally? One night when I'm busy, he wants me. And then when I'm not busy, he doesn't want me, doesn't want my stories.
Yeah, I think the only way to process that is to understand that your child or children in their own heads are a kind of royalty figure, and you are nothing but a serf or a kind of servant to attend to their every need and whim. And they are capricious, like a kind of ancient rulers. Ours is the same, absolutely identically ill-behaved. Sometimes they're amazing and they do the most incredible things and say the most moving things, but they are sometimes just insert swear word.
Yeah, and well, but then so yeah, I just want to provide a flip side so that people know I don't hate my children. I was giving the four-year-old a bit of a bollocking the other day, and he was denying that he'd done something he'd done. And I said to him, "Come off it, mate! You haven't got a leg to stand on." And the elder boy popped his head around the door and said, "Well, unless we get him a prosthetic." And I'm thinking, "You're seven. How do you even know what a prosthetic is?"
Yeah,
and that made me laugh a lot.
Yeah, mine are a bit older. But we still have many moments like that. So yeah, I empathise wholeheartedly.
Yeah, you never recover from having them in a way, and you'll never ever, I think, get that sense of freedom back. That you know that you, if you go out on a night out away from the children and you just want a night to yourself and to feel free, you'll never feel free again, because that responsibility that will always be there. That'll never go. You'll never be 20 and have, you know, an absence of responsibility ever again. So you'll never feel free again.
You do kind of get a glimmer of it sometimes, though. So my son's 10, my daughter's 15. And so we're just at the stage where we started to be able to, me and my husband, to go out a little bit, because the 15-year-old can babysit, which is a dream. Wow. And also means that you can like go out and it doesn't cost you, you know, 150 quid for a babysitter and then a meal and then the train or whatever. So that's nice too. But yeah, there was always that moment, I think, where I think we went out recently and it was like, yeah, you have that thing where I should get back, we should get this train because I need to get back with the kids and don't want to be too late. But then there's also that little bit in my brain that's like, oh, we could just like sack it off. Just fuck it. Let's stay out. And then obviously we do go home, but you still kind of get that slight feeling, which is quite a rush.
Well, that feeling of I might neglect my children.
Yeah.
That's where you get your rush.
Yeah, yeah.
You could just get a plane.
Yeah. And go somewhere.
We could just leave. Obviously, kids love you very much and always come home. Yeah, I was going to ask though on the practicalities of writing, Imran, because, you know, you obviously have this hugely successful career as a barrister, which I imagine is no small feat to keep up with that workload in chambers. But
certainly no small fee.
But we often talk to writers, and it's sort of one of the depressing sides of writing that it's really difficult to actually earn a living solely as a writer. Is that something that you would like to do or not want to do anyway, because you'd want to have those two kind of interests always?
Yeah, I'm really lucky because I think I've got a nice balance, so that I do some court work in the week and I do some writing in the week. I'm not doing, for example, I know Tony Kent does these long 6-week, 8-week trials. I don't do those. I do short trials. But it means that I'm not tied up for 6 weeks. And it also means that I can usually knock off kind of work-wise at 3 o'clock whenever I need to collect the children, or 4 o'clock, and still find time in the weekend or during the day to do some writing. So I'm really lucky. I've got a really nice balance, but it is an important issue, I think, this idea and this question of writers being paid properly, because not everybody has the kind of privilege that I have of being able to do both. And if you're concentrating only on writing and you're not making a living from it, then you end up delivering something to the world which is important culturally and, you know, can last lifetimes and it can be life changing. And you know, there have been numbers of times when I've thought to myself, or I've read a book, and in a way, it's kind of changed my life, or it's kind of rescued me from the edge of depression, or you know, and there are books in your life which are kind of signpost your life and are markers to way, you know, where you were in your life at the time you read a book. So that it's so important. But if you can't pay a writer, the industry can't pay a writer properly, then those kind of books will start to die out, I think, which would be a great shame. Because you need, also, I think a writer needs time to develop craft, and you won't always, very few writers are the best that they've ever been with their debut. They tend to happen as they get better, as they mature. And if you don't give the writer the remuneration to enable them to produce books over their lifetimes, then I think as a kind of culture, we'll miss out enormously on the things that they might have offered us, might have given us. You know, how many life-changing novels have we missed out on because, you know, a writer can only earn 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 a year from, you know, from writing a book, which, you know, might have taken them 2 years or 3 years or longer to produce.
Mm-hmm. There's a lovely...
Keep it light, mate.
Well, I'm not going light now, so it's a perfect juxtaposition, actually, Imran, because I want to read the acknowledgement that you've written to your dad at the end of the book, because I found this really moving. So I'll read it, and then there is a question that follows. To Dad, who wanted me to read always, to make up for the reading that wouldn't come to him, thank you for all those stories you left for us, and for that smile, and for being proud, whether I deserved it or not. We are coming to you slowly but surely. We are all but a blink away, and the thought of your face is enough to make me braver about it. Regarding the first part of that and the thanking your dad for the stories, and talk to us about how much of your early years informed wanting to be a writer. What was the situation? How many books did you have access to? What was the reading habits of father, son?
So dad came from a country where there was no free education. And so large swathes of that population in Pakistan weren't educated. And it was a real privilege. And so when they came to, when Dad came to Britain in the late 50s, it felt to him like a kind of treasure chest, I think, that the idea that you could go through a kind of, and the wealth of education that was on offer for free, and libraries that were on offer for free. And so, and he understood straight away the importance of it, because he came from somewhere where you couldn't have access to it automatically. So when we grew up, he had always insisted that we read, even though he couldn't read himself. He knew how important it was. He made us sit down and read whatever there was to be read. And we didn't have books because, you know, when we were growing up, Dad was working night shifts. Money was tight. I was growing up in the 70s. People were on strike, particularly in Liverpool. Workers were being laid off. And so we went to the local library. And I would read whatever I was reading in the library. You know, at home, we had hardly any books. If we had a couple of books, they were books that we would read over and over and over again until the pages dropped off them. But nearly everything that we read was from the library. And for that reason, he was happy for us to go there and to spend all evening there after the school. And we did. I'd finish school at whatever it was, 4 o'clock, and sit in the library till it shut at 9 or 10.
Wow. It's a lovely acknowledgement. Mm. Really lovely.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. No, it is super nice. I know that our time is almost running out, so I just wanted to ask briefly again from the acknowledgements. You say this is the first book that's got a US publisher, a US deal. So how does that feel? How does that change things? What does that mean to you? Presumably, yay, financially, but also creatively too.
Yeah. So I've been... Having a US deal is something which has always eluded me. And that's, I think, partly because my debut of the United States thought that book was quite English and quite British, and it involved the British legal system. And because of the way it was written in kind of quite London heavy dialect, that it wasn't really for them. And then the next book was also set in London, and the America's got a very difficult market to tap into, because whatever you try and write, they will always, in a way, have a kind of better version of the thing that you're trying to write about. So if you're trying to write about very grim inner city, they have much more grim inner cities. If you're trying to write about drug violence involving stabbings, they can write about drug violence involving guns, machine guns. If you're writing about prison violence, there are prison violence as well. So so for that reason, it's always quite difficult. And the people I think who do well in this in America are those who can not only write beautifully and also write a good plot, but produce particularly if they're writing about a book set in England or Britain, if they can produce a version of Britain that the Americans want to read about, probably a stylized version of Britain, and that is the thing which tends to appeal to them. So if you're writing a book which is where setting is important. So if I was going to write You Don't Know Me or any of the other books, I would probably have written it in a slightly more stylized version of London rather than the London that they got. But I think with Finding Sophie, although setting is important, it wasn't as dominant in this latest book as it was in the other books. What was more, what took center stage more were the characters and the issues and the themes which were driving the book. And I think that was, and it's about parenthood and it's about loss, and these are universal themes. And I think those are the things which appeal to them. And it could be a game changer for me. It might not be, but the market's so much bigger there. And we've got a market of however many people who are reading age here. And they've got a market which is 5, 6, 7 times bigger than that. And, you know, we'll keep my fingers crossed and hope it does well. But, you know, quite a lot of that is a lottery. I've done the bit that I can do, which is to write the book, and I just hold my breath for the rest and see what happens. But it is different. There are things that they don't want in their books compared to what the British taste is for what they'll put up with in their book. And when I was sending an early draft of, I'd completed the book for my publishers in the UK. And then we'd sent it off to the States, and they said, yeah, we like this, but we need to change some of it. And I said, oh, what do you need to change? They said, we need to get rid of this character because we can't have a character who does that. Okay. And then one of the other things was, there's a dog in Finding Sophie, but the way that the dog was originally dealt with was different in the original version.
Was it a bit more dead calm?
It was a bit more dead calm. And they said, yeah, we can't have violence to dogs. And I said, well, okay, well, I can have a look at that. And they said, no, you can't. We can't have it. And I said, well, can we have a conversation? No, we can't have a conversation about it. You can't have it. I said,
wow.
Okay. And I said, you can't have a threat of violence to a dog either. And I said, really, isn't that bad? They went, no, we've been through this a million times. It just won't land. They don't like it. They won't have it. I'm telling you, just don't do it. So yeah, so they have slightly different sensibilities, which is slightly odd, because you can't threaten violence to a dog. You can murder children.
Right, one more quote for you, Imran Mahmood, from your book, right? Before we ask you for some recommendations. Flipping through the manual, I see there are a million things to learn before I can safely use this machine, setting pathways, correcting navigational drift, and not least of all, how to fly the damn thing without crashing it. The damn thing in question is a drone. Did you take your research to the nth degree for this book, and are you now the owner of a drone? That's my question.
You know, I really, really do want a drone. And there was a time when I thought, well, I quite like a drone, because I think we had an issue with the roof. And I thought, actually, one way of looking at the roof is to fly a drone over it and have a look at it. But it turns out it's illegal to fly a drone in heavily built-up areas. And so, yeah, so I haven't got a drone, but I have been reading manuals about drones because I had a feeling that if I didn't get that bit right, somebody would write in and say, well, I've got one of these drones, and I think you'll find that you can't set it to compensate for drift unless you've also got the anti-collision setting on or whatever. Better get that bit right.
See, I read that passage and I just thought, in my imagination, I had an image of Mrs. Mahmood going, Imran, Imran, and then saying to the girls, where's Dad now? And then you're outside, flying this drone. But no, I'm sorry, I've misjudged, I apologise.
We've got a little tiny one that you can fly in this, but not a big one, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of drones. I think they're annoying. So shall we get some recommendations from you, Imran? What other books do you love recently or not so recently that you would like to share to other people?
Okay, I would like to share with you. Okay, so I'm currently reading Natasha Polley's The Mars House. Yeah, I'll show you the cover because it's beautiful. But it's a Natasha Polley is a stunningly gifted, and for that reason, annoying writer who has... the imagination of about 50 people. I don't know how she does it, but she every one of the books that she writes, they're all standalones. They're not really crime or at all crime, but they are all stunning, and I'm reading that and loving it.
What's it called again, mate?
It's called The Mars House. And it
the
is
Mars
about,
House.
It's set in a kind of near future, slightly dystopian, and we are at a point in history where there are people now living on Mars, in small communities, and they've been living there for some generations. And it has meant that because the gravity is a lot lower than it is on Earth, they grow a lot taller, but they're not as strong as the people on Earth. Earth, meanwhile, is on fire and everybody's trying to leave Earth. And the ones who have gone recently to Mars are called Earth Strong because they're so strong compared to the people who are five generations in, born in Mars, that they are dangerous. And so there's a kind of apartheid, not quite, but there's a kind of system in place which is designed to keep the Earth strongers under the cosh. And yeah, it's that's not doing justice to the plot, but it's a stunning book. If you get a chance to read it, it's out, it's just out, I think, March 24th, it says on the...
So that's The Mars House, Natasha Pulley, Pulley.
That's it. Yep. Helen Fields with Profile K, out in April. So this is also another stunning. Helen Fields is such a brilliant writer, and the kind of attention to detail in terms of plot and character on this one is off the charts. But and it's a frightening, but also kind of mesmeric book, and I would recommend it wholeheartedly. She's getting better and better. They all are. I think this goes back to what I was saying earlier. I think writers on the whole, if they're given the time to develop, they do get better and better. And she certainly is. So I definitely recommend that. Profile
K. Helen Fields with an S at the end, not to be confused with the Bridget Jones's Diary Woman. And this is out 25th of April.
And so when you're reading crime thrillers like that, are you... Does it feel like kind of research? Can you enjoy them, or are you trying to work out how they did it to sort of inform your own writing?
That's a really good question. And I think having had a book out definitely changes the way that you look at all books. In some ways, it does slightly ruin it because when I'm reading it, I'm thinking, oh, that kind of plot development's quite good, or I quite like the way this character development is going. That's quite a good way of putting it in. Or I think that this probably needs a bit more dialogue here to get the balance right. Or the pacing's falling off. All of this stuff, which I would never have noticed before.
Previously,
previously. But one of the things I think you can't ever do is to copy the thing that somebody else has done. Because everybody's style is so different. There's no way I could write a Helen Fields, and there's definitely no way I could write a Natasha Pulley. I don't have the brain size that she must have to write that book. I remember listening to a writer who was talking about a book that they'd written, and it had won all the awards for something. And she was saying, oh, you know, it may look as if I've plotted this work with such attention to detail to bring all of these million strands together. No, it's Hilary Mantel. But there's no way that anybody could plot the book that I've just written. She said, even I couldn't do it. There's no way you could do it. But what you're doing is you're taking a lifetime's worth of experience and reading, and it's just filtering in there somehow. It's kind of you've absorbed it. And
so it's pure
it's
alchemy
there on the page. Mm-hmm. I think there is definitely something in that, and I think that's why you can't replicate somebody else's style very well. You know, there are people who do it, who are ghostwriters, but it's very difficult to do unless you're doing something with, you know, very particular kind of formula, which is why I hope that AI never ever succeeds in being able to sell a decent book or write a decent book. I hope it never happens, and I think it won't happen for that reason.
Very good. Thank you very much for your recommendations. Thank you for coming on the podcast and enlightening us. It's always a pleasure to spend some time with you, and I always feel like I go away feeling a bit cleverer after I've spoken to you.
Yeah.
That's very kind of you both to have me on your wonderful show. I always feel very welcome when I'm in your presence. And next time I see you, the drinks are on me.
Now, I know you've spoken on this podcast before about having written a book, and you've got your agent, and it's not quite found a publisher yet, and you're onto book two. So that's where you are as a writer. Was it heartening for you to hear Imran at the end there talking about how this is his first US deal and the US market's so much bigger, but it's a bit of a lottery? And this is a guy who's had tremendous success, and even he's saying that it's to get your book out there and to get it read, he's a bit of a lottery.
Yeah, and is it heartening? I think it probably just... I'd say, I wouldn't say it's heartening, but I'd say it just shows the realism of life as an author, or in our cases, hopeful authors, in terms of having a published book. Because
I suppose I meant heartening because it's nothing to do with you personally or what you do. Do you know what I mean?
No,
it just shows how
true.
Hard it is for even people with track records, and you haven't got a track record yet. You're looking to establish one. Even those with track records are still struggling to break through in different territories.
Yeah, I think so. And I think also just because... you know, it almost should be that the work comes first, which I think it does, as in, you know, it is really hard work to write a book and to write it in such a way that other people want to read it and want to publish it and want to market it. I think I very much believe, along with Imran, that sense that I just want to get better each time I write. You know, I don't want the first thing that I publish to be the best I can ever be. I always want to be improving. And so I think it's sort of, it helps, I guess, feed into that narrative that maybe some of those things, obviously it'd be great if they did come with your first book, right? But that it takes a bit of time, and that those treats will come maybe a little later on.
And also, don't you think it's be careful what you wish for? Do you remember all those years ago when we started this podcast and we did David Nichols? I think you asked him the question about what happens when you have a book like One Day, which is such a success. And I definitely remember him saying, you know, that it put question marks in his head about could he ever match that again. I think if you have an extraordinary hit like that, it must be tricky then for the next thing you create to you constantly almost measuring up to your previous, whether it's a single, an album, a book, whatever the artwork is, you know?
Yeah, I think I might have said this before on this podcast as well, but I also remember speaking to incredible songwriters, Pasek and Paul, who wrote the songs for, they did some of the songs for La La Land, they wrote the songs for The Greatest Showman. They're doing some songs for Disney right now, but they won an Oscar for the song they did for La La Land. And they said the thing they struggled with was that the morning after you win an Oscar, basically every idea you do is great. So everyone says, yeah, it's great. Love it. It's great. And they've got no measure of actually creatively whether that
That's
is
hilarious.
A good thing that they've
they
written.
They just want you. They want the heat.
They just want you. Yeah. They can sell it then because it's from an Oscar winner. So I think I can appreciate that. That kind of must mess with your own self-critical judgment of whether you're producing something that you are happy with, or if people will just take it because they can sell it.
Comes back to trusting your gut, really, doesn't it? When you're creating something, and if you like it, and writing it for you, you wrote that book for you. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and keeping hold of that, I think, is quite difficult to do as well, because also, again, as Imran was just saying in this week's episode, it's, you know, it's a privileged position to be able to spend time writing as well as alongside working and, you know, getting money to pay the bills and pay the mortgage and look after kids and all that kind of thing. So, yeah, I think just knowing how you're using that time and using it wisely and respecting that time as well is quite a balancing act sometimes.
Right. If you'd like to help us with our balancing act for this podcast, then you can give us a little metaphorical coffee if you can spare the change at ko-fi.com. That's ko-fi.com/bestsellerspodcast. Otherwise, we will be back next week with the one and only Jenny Godfrey. It's The List of Suspicious Things, and it is the best book I've read this year. And I know we're only 3 months in as we speak. Maybe four as you listen, but it's the best book I've read this year and also the best debut I've read since Girl on a Train.
Talking about pressure on that debut, eh, Phil?
It's phenomenal. It's really good. I know you haven't started it yet, but you'll have.
I have started it.
Oh, yeah. You haven't started it, yeah?
I have, yeah. Very much enjoying it, yeah.
Good. Pleased to hear it. So, yeah, Jenny with us next week.